Many failures in Sefer Bamidbar, but this is the most tragic and the most historic. And it's a fall at a national level, and it's a fall at a personal level, because as the parasha introduces, these were Nisian. You'd expect leaders to show a little backbone, you'd expect leaders to have a little perspective and a little proportion, and they exhibit neither. And we'll talk about that a bit later. But amongst this mob of people that rally against Moshe's authority, against Kutcha Brichu, there are two people who stand out, who buck the trend. Two heroes emerge from Parsha Shlach, on a positive note, Yoshua and Kalev. These are two people, the only two people, textually, at least, who will enter Eretz Yisrael from the generation of Yotzei Mitzrayim. Chazal tells about Serach, the daughter of Asher, and all sorts of mythical people who outlasted the toll of the dead. But textually, these are the two people who are selected to enter when everyone else is barred. And where did they get their inspiration from? Where did they get their conviction from? So Rashi, in a very, very neatly packaged, two sheets, guys, Rashi in a very neatly packaged portrait, actually compares and contrasts Yoshua and Kalev. So let's take a look at source number Aleph, part one. It's a Gemara in Sota, Daf Lamed Daled. Vayalu Banegev, they ascended the land from the south. They entered at the southeast corner. They made their way from southeast to southwest, and then they made their way from southwest to northwest, and then they returned. They effectively covered the entire southern border and the western border. Vayalu Banegev, these Meraglim, these 12, ascend in the south. Vayavo at Chevron, and he arrives in Chevron. Very strange. They ascended, and he arrived. Chevron is south, so that would be a logical milestone to discuss. You're not going to describe every little pit stop, every little sojourn, but Chevron's an important one. They ascended and he arrived. Who's the he that seemed to part ways with the journey, even in its itinerary? So the Chazal tell us, Amar Rava, it's a Gemara in Sota. Melame Chapirish Kelev, Kalev, Ve'atzas Meraglim. Kalev, here are two sheets please. Kalev deviated. Two sheets, are there two sheets? Deviated from the plan, from the conspiracy of the Meraglim. V'holach v'nishtateach al-kivrei avos. And he went to Davin in Chevron. Only one person visited Chevron, that was Kalev. Amar lehem avosai, bikshu alai rachamim, shein notzel me'atzas Meraglim. Strengthen me, inspire me, grant me the courage to withstand this fomenting, rising crisis. But there's more to Kalev's tefillah. Listen carefully to his tefillah. Yoshua, maybe he said this, maybe it's just Rashi explaining, Kfar Bikesh Moshe Elav Rachamim. Yoshua already had his support system. Yoshua already had his strength. Moshe had already davened. Moshe already called him in for a personal interview. Vayikra Moshe Yoshua ben Nun Yoshua. He already renames him. He informs him of the brewing crisis. He encourages him to stand his place, stand his ground. Kayosh Yacha Me'atzas Meraglim. V'hainu d'chsev ve'avdi kalev ekev haisa. Josh, two sheets. Please, everyone take sheets when you come in, okay? Ve'avdi kalev ekev haisa ruach acharis imo. Kalev had a different spirit. When we read the pasuk about Kalev's different spirit, we assume it means that he withstood the Meraglim's infidelity. But according to Rashi, Kalev ekev haisa l'kalev ruach acharis imo, he had a different ruach, a different source of inspiration, a different place that he got his strength from. It wasn't the expected Moshe Rabbeinu calling him in as Moshe called in Yehoshua to inspire Kalev. He had to locate, he had to identify his own Ruach Acheres. So the simple read of the Pasuk, V'avdi Kalev, Ekev HaYisem Ruach Acheres, he had a different spirit to withstand the Meraglim. According to Rashi, he had a different source of inspiration. What's happening in this contrast, this dichotomy between Kalev and Yehoshua? Yehoshua, in many respects, has it easy. Yehoshua grew up in the tent of Moshe. Yoshua is schooled and lessoned day by day, minute by minute by Moshe Rabbeinu. He has that all-important Rebbe in his life. Anytime he has a question, turns to Moshe. Anytime he wants Torah, turns to Moshe. Anytime he falls, turns to Moshe. He has a whole list of the times that Moshe corrected him. At the foothills of Har Sinai, when he assumes it's people warring or orgying, whatever, Moshe just says, Ein kolanos, kolanos anichi shomei. Moshe tells him, not what you think. When Moshe in Parshas Balosli, Yeshua wants Moshe to incarcerate Eldad Omeida, to imprison them, maybe to destroy them. Moshe says, as we talked about last week, that should be our biggest problem, that people have too much nivuah, that people are too interested in religion, that they're misexpressing their avodas Hashem. That should be the biggest problem. Don't get all puritanical. Don't get all zealous about how people keep their avodas Hashem. Just be happy that there's passion. Be happy that there's intensity. So Yeshua has this long litany of stories with Moshe, moments with Moshe, going to battle literally with Moshe in Parshas B'Shalach, say, B'char lanu anashim tzei lachem ba'amalek, Moshe tells you. So Yeshua enters this battle armed, prepared, equipped. He's readied. His whole career has been, one could say, a build-up to this moment. This is his moment. This is his time. This is the time that will separate men from boys. And Yeshua towers as a man. But Kalev doesn't. Kalev doesn't have any priors with Moshe. And we know that Kalev happened to be Miriam's son, but Torah doesn't really tell us what Kalev's priors were. Kalev's grandson. He comes, Dibre Yam attaches Kalev to Miriam.
I think Avinashra says it.
Is that really?
Because it's different to the others.
Right, right. So he has some relationship, either genealogical or not, but even if it does, even if it is, as the pasuk in Dibre Yam suggests, even if it does, we don't see it in the text. We don't see Kalev actually learning from Moshe. There's a, I didn't quote the psukim. There's a text in Divrei Yamim that associates Kalev with Miriam, and as Yonas is pointing out, the genealogy doesn't match up. But there's a lot of discussion about that. But the point is, Kalev has to find his own connection to his past. He has to find his own history. He has to find his own legacy. He has to travel all the way to Hebron to uncover our common avos and deeply, deeply identify with those common avos. And even though those avos may be thousands of years, in this case hundreds of years in the past in Kalev's case, he's able to identify with them in an intimate and personal fashion and make them a true part of his life and a true source of inspiration. And that's why Chazal is showcasing the contrast between Yeshua and Kalev. Yeshua has a Rebbe. Kalev doesn't. And he's still able, even in the absence of that Rebbe, to try to locate in his past and in shared past. Sometimes people that we share a past with, oh, Avram, what can I really learn from Avram? He's the father of all of our people. How can you take Avram Avinu and see him as your Zaidi, as your Bubby? How many, I remember listening once to someone speak about a year ago and they calculated, okay, how many generations have passed since Har Sinai? I don't know what yardstick they're using for generations, and I don't exactly remember the exact detail, but it came to be like 60-something Bubbies and Zaidis since Har Sinai. Sometimes we take these ancient episodes in our past and we make them very, very antiquated, very remote. Then all of a sudden you figure, has it been so long ago? You got from your grandfather, he got from his grandfather, and he got from his grandfather, he got from his grandfather. If you say that sentence about 60 times, you're back at Har Sinai. And Kalev has this ability, even in the absence of a Rebbe, to find not just personal, but collective sources of inspiration and literally daven in Maariv HaMakpela, not just as a tourist trap, but realize, these are people who speak to me. These are people whose life impacts mine. And this is my moment, and I'm going to be inspired. What are you inspired by in life? And that's really a very good lesson, especially for the boys that are leaving, though not exclusively. Different times in life, it's really important, even when you leave yeshiva, to continue to find Rabbanim. If you don't have Rabbanim in your life, then you're morally and, of course, religiously adrift. And so much of the ills that afflict modern Orthodox society, other societies that we come from, it's the absence of rabbinic authority. As Yonason can tell you, in the Haredi world, there is a strong emphasis on rabbinic authority. Some would say maybe even exaggerated. It's called Das Torah. And Rav is consulted about everything, even things that aren't halachic or even moral, at least in its appearance, and what type of surgery to have, what type of house to buy, what type of car to purchase. So some would call that exaggerated, some wouldn't. But even if it's exaggerated, it still creates rabbinic presence and rabbinic authority. In fact, I was reading an article this past weekend in one of the newspapers and talking about a new phenomenon of called Haredim Chadashim, Haredim that work. So these people feel that they're Haredim. So they were trying to say, well, what's the profile of a Haredi if work is no longer a defining factor? It used to be if you work, you want a Haredi, but today there are still a lot of Haredim as in America that are working. So one of the things they said, one of the criteria that defines a Haredi is you accept Samchus HaRabbanim unquestionably. Whatever the Gedolim say becomes your position. Now, I don't tout that, which is why probably no one would call me a Haredi. I don't feel that there should be this overriding Das Torah that should dictate political decisions. Think halacha, you have to be submissive to a Rav. You don't know as much halacha as a Rav does. When it comes to general halachic and ishkafic issues, you should listen really carefully, almost at the point of direct instruction. When it comes to life decisions, you should hear out a Torah voice. So many people today have nothing even close to that. We self-arbitrate, we self-mediate knowledge, we self-mediate religion. I'll do what I think is right, my own inner compass, my own inner voice. That's terrible. that leads to a complete aggression of any systemic religious commitment. So you have to find Rebbeim. Just because you leave yeshiva and you don't have the Rebbeim that you may be more comfortable with doesn't exempt you from finding a Rebbe, and also doesn't exempt you from the challenge of even filtering a Rebbe. Just because the local rabbi in your community doesn't bring the entire package that you're accustomed to from high school or you're accustomed to from yeshiva. His hashkafa is a little different from yours. His derech halima is a little different from yours. At the very, very least, appreciate his halachic knowledge, appreciate his yirah shamayim, hopefully he possesses it, appreciate his midos and his striving for moral improvement. So often, if we don't get the full frequency attuned, we're not able to listen at all to the music. And we deprive ourselves of very, very meaningful relationships that can really add to us. Sometimes you get spoiled, because you come to places where you find that perfect rav, the perfect set of rabbanim, and they just match everything you're looking for, and then you become spoiled / childish, because it really is immaturity. I can't take unless I find a similar Rebbe. You're not always going to have that luxury. Certainly, the more that you drift from Torah centers, the more desperate you may be. And beggars can't be choosers, and whatever rabbinic services and rabbanim you find, you have to cling to. And this doesn't just limit itself to the time you're developing and growing as a yeshiva bachur, as a college student, but it is Hashem. One of the questions I want you all to ask yourselves when you build a house, when you build a family, will there be rabbinic presence in your home? The best thing you could do for your children is host a shir, or host a visiting rabbi, or this is not a plug, don't worry. Plenty of places to stay. The best thing you could do is to create Torah presence. What do you want your children to see you doing? Do you want your children to see you learning? And even if they can't see you learning, at least to see you loving Torah and loving Rabbanim and inviting them and taking them and traveling with them. And those of you who have seen it in your homes, you know it makes a difference. You know it establishes. And those of you who haven't seen it, it's no fault of your own. Certainly it's no fault of your parents, and maybe you didn't have the exposure, but it's something you have to, when Chazal speak about it, in Pirkei Avos, Yehi Beischa Beis Vad L'Chachamim, you turn your home into a meeting place for Chachamim. So it doesn't have to be on a weekly basis, but even from time to time, if there's someone announces a certain Rav is coming to town, who's going to host the shir, your hand should fly up in the air immediately. I want to host the shir. I want my children to see Torah in my home. But you don't always have that. And in the absence of a Rebbe at any level, are you able to become a colleague? Are you able to become someone who, I don't necessarily have that Rebbe with me, but I'll find personal inspiration. It won't just be personal inspiration based on, well, I certainly have gedolim in my life. I certainly have people, may not have been genetic, may not have been direct rabbanim, but I can read about the Rabbi Akivas and the Rambams and the Chasam Sofers and feel myself part of it. You know, one of the challenges, Jonas, and that we have in our cultures, the Haredi culture is very, very adamant about creating that sense of Masara through gedolim stories, and you know all the names and who the great gedolim and the various yeshivas were. That's not part of our litany. That's not part of our educational model. And sometimes I don't know that boys feel enough connected. So your dress is a little different from the way boys may have dressed or may dress in certain yeshivas today. But the spirit's the same. You're still B'nai Torah. You're still learning B'nai Baruch Hu's Torah. You're still trying to strive in your Yerushalayim. You're still trying to... So you should see yourself as part of the great yeshiva movement. And Gush is part of this movement. And it took a little, its own flavor. And then there are other yeshivas alongside of it. And say, well, I come from something special. I come from a great, great legacy of people that are committed to Torah, that are committed to Torah mitzvahs in a serious manner, and be able to go back through the generations and find different personalities to be inspired by. So you have to have a little bit of Yeshua and a little bit of Kalev in you. You have to find those Rebbeim. If it's just past generations, it's always easy to be a ventriloquist with dead people. It's always easy to put the Rambam on your lap and make him say whatever you want him to say, because he can't defend himself. So if only you're being inspired by what previous generations had to say about, first of all, they're not even going to discuss many issues that are very current. They're not going to discuss internet and social media and electricity and organ donation and the State of Israel. You know, you can't even begin to imagine what the Shach would say about the State of Israel, because it was totally irrelevant, for that matter, anyone before the early to mid-19th century. So you can't just look back to your past. Some people find themselves more comfortable looking back to their past because it gives them greater creative space to make dead people say what they want them to say. Oh yeah, the Rambam today, if he were alive, he would definitely hold like me. The Rambam would definitely say, he'd definitely be a Zionist. He definitely wouldn't like this. There's no way for you to know. It's a totally different world, totally different set of circumstances. But just to look back at ancient personalities and imagine their examples, which is too general to be able to apply specifically to the unique cases and the personal circumstances of our society. So you have to have rabbanim that comment on halachic issues of the day, that comment on social issues of the day, that comment on more religious issues of the day. But it can't just be rabbanim, it also has to be people in the past. And one could say someone who's been a little bit in both worlds. It's sometimes the overemphasis on Karin Gedolim obscures people to the fact that there were previous generations who weren't always the same. The Ramban didn't speak Yiddish, the Ramban didn't wear black hat. It was obviously a different reality. So sometimes you put too much emphasis on the close and proximate generation or generations, it makes it harder to see that there were differences and to actually link to those differences and link to those personalities in previous generations. And Chazal are intentionally highlighting the difference. The Torah is highlighting. Yeshua, everyone sees. The Torah also wants us to see Kalev and to contrast Yeshua and Kalev. To see Yeshua's cozy relationship with Moshe. Moshe calls him in for an interview and says, you're going to face an incredible challenge. This is your moment. Face up to the challenge. I'm davening. Remember our relationship. Be inspired. Kal Yoshiach HaVetzas Meraklam. Kalev doesn't have that. He runs to Hebron. He davens on Kivri Avos and he asks them, there's another subtle difference between Yoshua and Kalev. It's a little bit different than the first issue I raised. It's not just where Kalev draws inspiration from, but that he draws inspiration, that he sees himself as a hero, that he sees himself. Sometimes people that come from rabbinic backgrounds, from rabbinic dynasties, and Moshe talked about this a little bit Friday night. If your last name is Lichtenstein, he didn't say this, or your last name is Soloveitchik, or your last name is Cutler, I feel like you come from a dynasty and you have a responsibility and you're part of the inner circle of people that are going to take Torah and take Am Yisrael by the reins and carry it forward. But what if your name is not one of those classic names? Or your name is, I don't know, Goldberg. I was picking a name out of the hat. You know, you're just your average Joe Goldberg. And you don't have a father who was a great Rav. You don't have a grandfather who was a big Rav or someone. And that's really the difference between, I'm sorry, Chaim, I just thought of that. Anybody know Chaim was in the room, okay? And Chaim's father happens to be a very, very well-known Rav, so I didn't even put two and two together. Okay, what if your last name is Goldberger? Yes. And some people just feel like, you know, I'm on the outside, I don't stand a chance, I'm not part of the inner circle, I don't have any background. Who am I? What am I? And the Torah specifically wants to highlight the difference between Yoshua's pedigree and Kalev's coming from nowhere. He's a nowhere man. And he's such a nowhere man that even his name is a bit almost irreverent. What does the word Kalev really sound like?
A Kalev.
Okay, so no one called him Kalev except for me because I made a mistake in the beginning. But you don't call a nobleman Kalev. That's a street name. That's a blue collar. That's a redneck name. It's a name you give someone that doesn't, despite possible associations with murder. But his name is very common folk. He wasn't one of these. Now again, he became an Ossi, so obviously he had some sway. He's part of some inner circle. But evidently, Yefuneh, wherever Yefuneh was, didn't carry the same pedigree as Noah, or at the very least, Kalev didn't possess the same pedigree as Yoshua by dint of his relationship with Moshe. And the story the Torah is telling you is, don't write yourself out. Don't assume that because you don't have that inner connection, that inner protexia, that your last name, it happens to be you married the right person, you happen to belong to, you went to the right high school. The very famous Ramban from the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha, which I told you about, but a lot of you weren't here, and some of these ideas need repetition. Avram has such a legendary past before he leaves for the land of Canaan. He smashes idols, he gets flung into the Kivshan Aish. Why don't we see any of this? We just meet Avram, Hashem calls a person anonymously, Lech Lecha, Me'artzecha, Mimoladcha, Ve'savicha. Why don't we see Avram the hero? Avram the giant? Avram the great, great inspired leader? So the Ramban's answer is, because the Torah doesn't really feel like discussing his past, because it has to do with Avodah Zarah. We're going to have to dredge up the stories of those ancient Avodah Zarahs. So technically, Sam the Torah like skips over that part because it's uncouth, it's unsavory. The Maharal has a different shot. The Maharal says, indeed, Avram had a storied past. But that's not the story the Torah wants you to read. The Torah doesn't want you to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu coming and selecting this great visionary leader and giving him another challenge. Because, you know, if that's the story you read, you say, well, I'm not that leader. I don't have such a story past. I don't face similar challenges and I don't have similar potential. The Torah wants you to read the following story, Josh. The Torah wants you to read the story of every man, of no man, nowhere man, a guy who has no background, who has no past, who has no reason, who has no man then. Hashem just picks him out for whatever reason and you grow with the job. And B'makom Shenish, you assume that title and you own it. And you stand up and you make a difference. Historically, Avram had all these reasons that he merited selection and all these resources that allowed him to stand up and make that move. But that's not the story the Torah wants you to see. The Torah wants you to see yourself in the mirror. I have nothing. I come from nothing. I have no merit. But Hashem offers me opportunity. Hashem offers me potential and talent and future. I'm going to seize it and become that person. That's the story of Kalev. We know nothing about Kalev before we read Parsha Shlach. But somehow he doesn't write himself out. In some ways, he's even more successful than Yeshua, Vayas Kalev Asam. In part because, according to Rashi, because he was less suspected, they were less suspicious of him. When Yeshua got up to speak, everyone knew whose side he'd be on. When Kalev got up to speak, oh, here's someone who's going to join this riot of Meraglim against Moshe. So according to Rashi, it was a strategical tactic, strategical asset. But it's more than that. Kalev was a common man. He just understood the common man's needs and his fears, and he could say things to them that would assuage or placate their concerns in a way that perhaps Yeshua couldn't. Sometimes he could be too aristocratic, too elitist, too removed from people. Sometimes if you grew up having a, so to speak, normal, average upbringing, sometimes you could have even more of an impact upon people because you understand average, normal people's arcs and lives in ways that maybe people who had straight shots and shortcuts to the top, so to speak, can't appreciate. You can appreciate people's struggles and you appreciate what messages people need to hear. So that's a different reason to contrast Yeshua and Kalev, because Yeshua is an insider and Kalev is an outsider. And ultimately, they reach the same finish line, more or less neck and neck, Eretz Yisrael, more or less receiving special roles and portions. But at least in Parsha Shlach, Kalev towers to a degree over Yeshua. He doesn't write himself out so often. It hurts me so often when people write themselves out of potential because they doubt their credentials, they doubt their past. There's so much to be done in our world today. There's so much. I mean, just take a trip anywhere out of the 20 miles that you live in the nucleus, unless you live in Eretz Yisrael. The nuclear world you live in, your own Jewish town, Orthodox town, and the need for a badam and mechanchim and people just to breathe Torah, halachic Torah, and an elegant, dignified human face. It's just, we're dying for people like that. People just, as Rav Moshe talked about the other night, they write themselves out of the equation. And I've been saying this to some blue in the face, solely for Southern Hemisphere boys. And how many rabbanim do we need in South Africa and Australia to bring the type of Torah that you're being exposed to here and inspire people. Would you imagine if you had, we say from Sydney, anyone from Sydney, right? If you had five of Davies instead of one, the whole world would be different. So someone's got to get up and make a difference. Someone's got to get up instead of just sitting on the sidelines letting other people carry that load. Someone's got to get up and have enough courage and vision and do something about it. So that's why the Torah talks about Kalev in hinted fashion. The Torah wants us to track the GPS of this one miragel. He's traveling to Hebron, while Yeshua doesn't need Hebron, but Kalev needs Hebron. So that's first of all. Second of all, let's take a look at Benos Salafcha. Very interesting. Why are we talking about Benos Salafcha? They don't appear in Parsha Shlach. They make their first appearance in Parshas Pinchas. But there's a word missing, several words missing from Moshe's Tefillah in Parsha Shlach that I want to contrast, interestingly enough, with Benos Salafcha. When Moshe Rabbeinu stood at Har Sinai at the Egel debacle, Kadosh Baruch Hu told him, I'm going to give you these 13 Midos HaRachamim, not just for you to study me theologically and understand me better, but to know how to daven. If you look in Rashi and Parshas Kitisa, then anyone remember Moshe's tefillah and Kitisa? What did he base his tefillah on? Don't destroy the Jewish people. Why? Zechor li Avram li Yitzchak li Yaakov. Remember the schus of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And also, he said, "Lama yomur mitzrayim beraotziam larogos amberim ulachalosam el pinyat demah." What are the Egyptians going to say? Those were the two premises of Moshe's great tefillah. They have schus avos, and the goyim are going to say sham d'sham d'sham. Sham in Yiddish means it's embarrassing. So you don't want to be guilty of betraying schus avos of Kadosh Baruch Hu, and also you don't want the goyim to badmouth your intentions. Hashem tells Moshe effectively at Har Sinai after the Egel, that's not enough. You can't daven for Schus Avos. There's going to be a time in history when Schus Avos expires. Gemara in Shabbos, Tamu Schus Avos. Schus Avos expired after 2,000 generations, 2,000 years. But according to all Shitas, Machlokes and Tosfos, how to interpret that Gemara, according to all Shitas, we no longer have Schus Avos. We may have something called Bris Avos, but not Schus Avos. 2,000 years. Lapayim. According to Tosfos. So Moshe is told by Kadosh Baruch Hu, you can't rely on Schus Avos, it's not going to last forever. Lama Yamu Mitzrayim won't always be that effective. But Hashem tells Moshe, here's a separate way to daven, here's a more powerful way to daven. Invoke the Yudgul Midos HaRachim, Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum Mechanun, Erech HaPayim, Rav Chesed V'Yemes, Kol Zman Sheyasu Rufanak Yisedir Azeh. Anytime, the Gemara Rosh Hashanah says, Moshe was told by Hashem, they recite the 13 Midos HaRachim, I promise you, I'll never return empty-handed. They'll always have an answer. What was the first time that Moshe actually employed the Yudgul Midos? this week's Parsha. This week's Parsha, where Moshe Davins on behalf of Am Yisrael, he actually recites the Yud Gimel Midos the first time, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu taught him Yud Gimel Midos after Moshe's Tefillah on the Eagle. Moshe's Tefillah was successful. Hashem forgave Am Yisrael, but Hashem told Moshe, be careful because you're going to need a new voice with Tefillah. Here's your new voice. But the Meraglim was the first time Moshe Rabbeinu invoked Yud Gimel Midos, which is why Moshe says in Parsha Shlach, V'yata Yigdal Makoch Hashem. No, finish the pasuk. Yigdal Makoch Hashem. Kasher Dibarta Lamar. You promised me that Yigdal Makoch Hashem, that by invoking Yud Gimel Midos, you told me. I'm not producing anything new. Kasher Dibarta. But he leaves out one of the Yud Gimel Midos, Moshe Rabbeinu. He leaves out a few of them, more than one, but I'm going to talk about one. Which Mida does Moshe omit in Parsha Shlach? He recites almost all the 13. You can check in the Pesukim. He omits the Mida, Notzer Chesed La'alafim. Do you remember the Schus Avos, the Bris Avos? Why did Moshe omit it? I could say, because that was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's point. Don't just daven based on Schus Avos. Find some davening that would be historical, even beyond Schus Avos. But at this point, it certainly was Schus Avos. And yet he omits it. So take a look at the Ramban, source number 1. Lo hiskir b'tzvah, so base 1, lo hiskir b'tzvah lazos, li Avraham, li Yitzchak, uli Yaakov, klal. Natam bavur sha'arif nitna li Avos, mehem Yerushua. The land was given to the Avos. V'hei mardim Avosam! By ridiculing Eretz Yisrael, by deriding Israel. They're abandoning up Yitzchak and Yaakov, lo yichafetz matana shalem, and they despise the land. Hey, Omar, Bach. You're going to ask the Kodesh Baruch Hu to save these people based on Am Yitzchak and Yaakov when they spit in Yaakov and Yitzchak's face. You can't invoke their schus when you betrayed everything they lived for. The entire dream was this land. The entire commitment was this land. So you can ask the Kodesh Baruch Hu for Rachmanis because he's merciful, because he's good, because he's Rav Chesed. But Moshe just couldn't imagine invoking Notzer Chesed La'alafim, asking the Rebbeinu Shalom to protect Am Yisrael because of Schus Avram, when they saw offended Avram by disparaging his land. And that becomes a great sin of the Meraglim. It's one thing not to live in Israel. It's one thing to have legitimate concerns. But it's a betrayal in the sense of hostility and disgust and apathy and indifference to what happens in Israel, and almost too strong or too scared. It's not a land we want. Eretz HaKadosh Yashvel. Chazal talk about it. I didn't quote this source for you, but it's such a stunning Chazal. Lama nismecha parshas Meraglim and parshas Miriam? Why the juxtaposition between the Meraglim and Miriam? And what does Chazal say? It's a Gemara. They didn't take the lesson of Miriam. Miriam spoke Lashon Hara. I should have realized I shouldn't speak Lashon Hara about Eretz Yisrael. What are you kidding me? You shouldn't speak Lashon Hara about Eretz Yisrael. Lashon Hara means I say something negative about tires, I'm hurting his feelings. That the land of Israel is going to be hurt if I say something negative about her. Well, Lashon Hara, what does Eretz Yisrael care what you say about her? No, but it's just, how could you be so bitter about something so important? And it's the derision and the lack of interest that's on such display, that's such a spectacle in Parsha Shlach. And every year, Parsha Shlach is your chance, right? There are certain times of the year you have to conduct a cheshbon nefesh. Shavuos is the time you conduct a cheshbon nefesh about your chelek in Torah, your asmada. Yom Kippur is the time you conduct a cheshbon nefesh about your overall religious behavior. B'shalach, a lot of people feel B'shalach is the time to conduct a cheshbon nefesh about your amunah, because B'shalach is a parsha of amunah. V'aminu b'Hashem v'Moshe Avdo. Hasidim felt it's time to think about amunah. To learn these little touchstone events during the year. Shalach's here. Let me think about where my moon is going. Shavuos is here. Where's my chelek in Torah? Shlach is a time for you to inspect where you stand in Eretz Yisrael. When I say where you stand in Eretz Yisrael, I don't mean where you stand, because you could be standing in different continents. That's something we talked about on Shabbos. But there's a difference between standing on a different continent and living Israel deeply and passionately. There's a difference between standing on different content and caring less, and cholila v'chaz, deriding or disgusting or disparaging. Or life in Israel is tough, life in Israel is difficult. Of course it is. But for so many people, it almost as if it's not important, and cholila v'chaz worse. All those Israelis, all the Israeli food, all the So if it's said in jest, the way you'd make fun of your brother or your sister or your friend, it's a way to, as long as you tell jokes, it's a way of chibah, it's a way to connect to someone. But if it's said with real lack of interest, with real, and I didn't want to say this at the Kiddush on Shabbos, but who asked that question? I think Olaf asked that question. What are some of the challenges facing the next community? And Rabbi Friedman answered some of the halachic challenges. But we're also facing a lot of challenges that aren't halachic, but are attitudinal and religious. One of them is social media. Social media is going to be something, it is already something that everyone is going to be using almost constantly. And how do you use social media as a bentara in a halachically appropriate setting? You have to face changing sexual modes in the overall society and how as an Orthodox community we navigate that. Big issue. Different forms of abuse that are becoming much more prevalent in society and we don't really have the tools. The old tools are no longer appropriate tools and the new legal systems. And one of the things we're going to have to face is I sense there's a polarization in the way people view Israel. I think that there's a shift or there's a rift happening. At least in the United States where I travel a lot, you guys can fill in the blanks, but it used to be that everyone more or less was on the same plane vis-a-vis their relationship with Israel. They all felt more or less committed to Eretz Israel. Wherever they lived, but they knew that Israel was an epicenter. And that's to a degree where they should be. And they, everyone pays lip service to things you don't really do, but you know should be done. Nishra Shabbos Garet, but how much money did you pay for that suit? Nishra Shabbos Garet, what did the Yankees do last night? Everyone, I wish I would have to speak about the Yankees on Shabbos, but yeah, I need to know the scores. So Nishra Shabbos Garet. That's right, I know it should be an Eretz Shabbos. Today there's a polarization. I think there are certain segments of our community that are thinking very, very deeply about Eretz Yisrael, even if they don't live in Eretz Yisrael, really feel part of it. And as some of the Rabbanim talked about on Shabbos, with all the technological and communication and transportation, you really can live it much more deeply than in the past. And those people are feeling it much more deeply. And then the other part of society, I think, is veering a little further away from identification with Eretz Yisrael, whether it's because of higher levels of comfort, I think higher levels of political comfort and cultural comfort. I think Jews are much more confident politically, much more comfortable culturally. You know, I was in the States, people were telling me, you go to any stadium near a major Jewish city today in America and find kosher food being sold at the stadium. You can buy kosher franks and kosher hamburgers and actually have minyanim during the intercession. In our day, when we went to these stadiums, we just felt like we were walking into a Goyish world. We enjoy the game. We felt this was a world that was different, that wasn't ours. You couldn't touch the food, you couldn't smell the food, you couldn't get near the... Everything was just, you're a visitor, you walk into a time machine, you're somewhere else. Now, I'm happy they're selling kosher food in the minyanim, but what are the cultural costs? Like, the more comfortable you feel culturally and politically, the fact that people are running... there's an article, again, excuse the non-Americans here for my patently American cultural access, but those are the things I still read. But you can probably translate it in lower levels, but in America it's very powerful. I just had this big article in America that a chassid was applying to become a policeman. And he was expelled from the police academy because his beard was a little too long and he refused to shave his beard and police decorum demanded that he shave his beard. So it made major news and it's in all the news outlets. In my day, the thought of a chassid with a beard being a policeman, I couldn't think of anything more incongruent. Hasidim being polite, what? It just didn't make sense if we were Irish and Italian. Now I'm happy it's occurring because it shows that we're entering society and we're wielding our influence in society, we're feeling part of it. There's a generally healthy society to be part of, but also demonstrates a certain comfort level we're establishing in society. This is our place and this is our home, and we should embrace those realities as we should and advance those realities and improve those realities. But to what extent is the price we pay attitudinal that we no longer feel? So it's not as acute as the chet of the Meraglim, who were vicious and who were hostile towards our land. They said negative things, Lashon Hara, literally, Motziya Dibas Haaretz L'Ra'ah. But it really is a chance every year, Parsha Shlach, to ask yourself, have I veered too far to the level of comfort? And have I lost some of my connection to my land? And am I somewhat guilty of a Meraglim-like disinterest? The Meraglim were not just disinterested. But am I guilty of, I can no longer look myself in the mirror and say, no tzur chesed la nothing. Because I'm no longer part of the experience of the Avos. As I said before, are you able to make the Avos' lives really compelling and really personal and really see yourself as a grandchild of Avram, a grandchild of Yitzchak, a grandchild of Rachel? And part of it is if you live in their land. And even if you don't have the schus to live in their land, if you feel like the schus that we have to own that land and to reside and settle that land, I want to try to be part of it whatever way I can. at the very least, to have that fondness, you know, the same way you're fond of a friend or a sibling or of a parent, and you know their faults, and you know their flaws, but you're still very fond of them. Same thing, we have flaws. It's not an easy country to build after 66 years with neighbors, lunatic, assassin, suicidal neighbors at every corner, trying to ingather 52 cultures and 52 gods. It's a hard country to build. It's a hard country to sustain. You should be proud of what we've been able to build. Just ask some of the boys from less developed countries that had a little more time to develop their countries and look at what we've been able to build in 66 years of endless and relentless pressure. And I think it's a kiddush Hashem. I think the fact that we are such an economic superpower, and the fact that we are a cultural, technological beast, so to speak, and I think these are things that we should be proud of, and shows us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is providing a supernatural thrust to our ark. And I wanted to contrast that with you, especially since a lot of boys are leaving. The contrast to the Meraglim only comes about a few parashios later by the Benot Selefchad. Because the Benot Selefchad are not people who deride their land, or are not people who are indifferent to the land. It would have been very easy for them to accept their fate, that they don't get any share in the land. The daughters of Selefchad, since males don't really inherit, at least they thought, and they demand, and they negotiate, and they plea, and we'll talk about this in Parashas Pinchas a little bit, how they negotiated with Moshe. Wasn't aggressive, it wasn't disrespectful, but it was still assertive, it was still desperate, it was still interested, it was still passionate. How do you strike that chord between real concern without being irreverent or disinterested in the context and the traditions? But just to show you the Gemara, those of you who have studied Bava Basra and have read Parashas Pinchas know that the laws of Yerusha are located in Pinchas in response to Benot Selefchad. They make their claim, and then all of a sudden Moshe Rabbeinu hands out the laws of Yerusha. Now the laws of Yerusha far transcend the daughters of Tzlafchad. Tzlafchad is one minor scenario under which the laws of Yerusha have to be re-engineered. And yet all the laws of Yerusha are delivered in a section in response to Benot Tzlafchad. The answer is, as the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, source 2, Kinitanya, Veruya Parshas Nachlos, Shetikasev, Ayyem Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe should have delivered the Parsha of Nachlos like every other Parsha. Elash Zachu Benot Tzlafchad, V'nichtar Al Yadon, there was Zocha. And the Gemara that I didn't quote, Mikan Shemegalbalim Schusle De Zaka. And if you're someone that's meritorious and virtuous and noble and pure, good things will happen. Even if your request isn't fulfilled, in this case it was fulfilled. They were Zochet to have the Parsha of Nachlos, the people who studied for thousands of years. Those Pesukim of Nachla, who gets Nachla first and second, they were responsible for the authorship, the authoring of this Parsha. So in the contrast between the Meraglim and the Benot Selefchad, you see two different attitudes towards Eretz Yisrael. You see one of contempt, one of disinterest, and you see one of love and concern, even when they had no reason to believe that their wish would be requested, would be granted. The very fact that they lodged that request, the very fact that they long, that they're wistful, that they want it. You don't have to live in Eretz Yisrael. Don't tell some of the Rebbeim I said that. Don't tell Rav Yehuda I said that. I think life today is too complex for anyone to say you have to live in Eretz Yisrael. I think it's very, very hard. A lot of factors that go into that decision. Family, profession. The longer you stay in Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz, the harder it becomes. Therefore, if you really want to live here, there's a lot of wisdom in getting here as early as possible before those complicating factors begin to occupy the puzzle. And you know, a lot of people have that. Ironically, those who come from less developed Jewish environments have an easier time making Aliyah. I can't imagine you can have, if you want to, have such a hard time. What are you leaving behind, Tyra? How do you really have? And, you know, if you lived in Brooklyn, you know, you walk down the street, you could find a shtiebel in every corner and a pizza shop on the other corner. You have potentially more shuls in Brooklyn than you have in most Israeli cities. So it's harder to leave a place where you have more Jewish resources, but then you get stuck. So it's the conundrum I spoke about before. You want to embrace the reality and advance it, but you don't want that to become a trap that prevents you from moving or for at least living a different alternate reality. So we have 15 minutes left, and I really have two things I want to talk about, but I'll talk about the one that's more practical, less visionary, but still very important. The end of Parashat Shlach talks about the mitzvah tzitzis. And in my opinion, the mitzvah tzitzis is probably one of the cutting edges or battle lines for many, many boys over the next couple of years. Especially those who won't be in Jewish or who won't be in passionately from environments. And because it's a mitzvah that you can so easily, so to speak, justify your way out of. Well, if I'm not wearing a four-cornered beged, I really don't have to wear tzitzis, I'm pater. Is that really the attitude you want to take to religion? To get by with as little as possible on putter? Is that really the road you want to take? So it's really a crossroads. Really, when you get to tzitzis, you're really looking at yourself in the mirror and saying, what type of Jew am I? Am I someone that runs towards mitzvahs, seizes opportunities, undergoes even slight discomfort physically or culturally? Or someone who always tries to back their way out of opportunities and pay heed to convenience and social framework and less to eternal values of mitzvahs and HaKadosh Baruch Hu? It's really a barometer. It's really a very healthy barometer of where you stand. And it's a good opportunity each year, especially for those who struggle with this mitzvah. And again, you can't just bring gambling's another example. You know, I'm sure every high school kid is a bucky in the sugya of gambling. Everyone knows the Gemara Nasvachta, the Gemara Sanhedrin. Is it usher? Is it not usher? Not gambling is not a halachic question. You don't need a halachic Gemara to tell you not to gamble. You don't gamble, especially in a larger sense. It's just unhealthy behavior. It's rude behavior. It's again, friendly little bets. I'll bet you a dollar my team wins. I'm talking about real gambling. Take other people's money away. What type of person? Certainly, and not ever in your life walk into a casino. Because the casino is an industry which is completely built to ruin people's lives. They hire experts, million-dollar experts, to see how can we beam in loud music and oxygen and bright lights just so that people will stay there, become addicted, lose their lives, lose their families, drink all night, succumb to prostitutes, do drugs, and throw themselves off a balcony. Not that extreme. I mean, they have it all figured out, but that's the burial site where people go to bury their lives. So people don't go there for constructive, productive behavior. Nothing productive is coming out of Las Vegas. The people go to, you know, act in ways that should be abhorrent, inconceivable. You can't just gauge activities based on halachic metrics. You have to think about, is this the place that Ben Torah should be? And in my wildest dreams, I would never want, unless they asked me to give a shiur, but in my wildest dreams, I would never step foot into a casino. Now, I can't even imagine being associated with such filth and such manipulation and such, exploitation of humanity. It's an ugly place to be. So tzitzis is a mitzvah. It's the easiest mitzvah, ironically, right? The three easiest mitzvahs are three mitzvahs. You get a mitzvah just for breathing, living in Israel, wearing tzitzis, and sitting in a sukkah. Three mitzvahs. I announced to my family on sukkahs, say, okay, every second you're getting three mitzvahs: sukkah, Israel, and tzitzis. Kaching, kaching, kaching. Next minute, kaching, kaching. Easy mitzvahs. It's not just, obviously, religion isn't a scoreboard in Shemayim, how many points click off every time you do a mitzvah. You have a sense that you're proud. The best defense is a good offense. You're proud to wear your tzitzis. You're proud that people, a lot of people are going to be struggling in the next couple of years with a Jewish identity in non-Jewish or certainly non-firm settings. And people can smell fear a mile away, but they can also smell inspiration a mile away. And these are the touchstone moments where you daven in public, you daven quiet, not arrogant, not getting in people's way, but you're proud for people to see you davening, proud for people to see your faith on display. Do you wear your tzitzis proudly? My minhag is not to wear my tzitzis out, but and I would never feel conscious if my tzitzis were out or something. You know, all of a sudden people are going to see that I'm Jewish. That's what I live for. I want people to know that I'm Jewish. I don't want to conceal. I don't want people to see it, but to see that I'm from. People to see that I live for something. So tzitzis really is a touchstone moment about how you see yourself in the broader society. Remember, a boy once came to me and he said his minhag is not to wear tzitzis out, but he thinks that now that he's going to university, he wants to start wearing the tzitzis out. Why? I asked him. He said because he feels like he has to start drawing lines. He's going to a second university. He felt as if he wants to be friendly with everyone, he wants to be embracing with everyone, but he needs a constant reminder to know who he is and what he is, that he's different. So whether it's your tzitzis or not, whoever's going to be in a university at any stage, you got to take that big D word. As much as you want to be an ear, an embracer, an integrator, you also have to realize you're different. At some point, you've got to find a way to maintain that, you know, red line in the sand and say, I am different, and those differences express itself by. I don't go to bars with my friends. Again, bars are in flux. If bars are a quiet place where people are having drinks, you know, non-intoxicating drinks, or it's just the fact that it has a bar outside. I'm saying places where there's flirtation going on and there's loud, you know, inappropriate music, inappropriate behavior, people getting drunk. I mean, That type of environment. You want to sit in a nice cafe. You know, today the boundaries between a cafe and bar blur. You know, you sit at a cafe and you have a cup of beer also. But a place that, ask yourself, is this a place that reflects who I am? Is this breathe me? If Rav Lechazin would come in now to the room and see me in this place, would I feel embarrassed and run out, or would I say sit down, you know, maybe have a croissant or something in French. Have a croissant or something. If you can answer that question, ask yourself concrete questions. So tzitzis is a good way. So he said he wants to keep his tzitzis out just to give himself a constant reminder. So let's read a few makaros in the 10 minutes that remain about the mitzvah of tzitzis. As the Torah says, "V'lo sasur achrei levavchem v'achrei nechem asher etem zanim achareihem man tizkiru v'asisem es kol mitzvasoi v'sem kidoshim elokechem." So now tzitzis helps us remember all the mitzvahs. How does tzitzis help us remember mitzvahs? So partially, we all know the Rashi in Menachos doesn't have any source in Chazal. Rashi devised it. What does Rashi say? How does tzitzis lead us to remember all the mitzvahs? Anyone remember?
Tzitzis is 600.
Gematria, right? 600, tzitzis is 600, and eight strings, and five knots, 613. So, as far as I know, it's not in Chazal, Rashi in Menachos. Yes,
it
is.
But it doesn't really apply to like, most of the Chayel tzitzis.
Why not?
Because they ground first down with grandma's 13.
Okay, so Rashi didn't put on chayos.
But there's
right. Okay, however, there's a different Gemara. It gives a different interpretation of how you can get to all the mitzvahs through tzitzis. I want you to listen carefully. It's an important Gemara. It's Reb Meir. It's a Gemara Menachos. Source number 3. It's a Gemara Chulin. The Tanya, Reb Meir Omer. Even according to the Rambam, my dear. Man ishtana tchelus mikolat sivonim. Why is tchelus chosen out of all the colors? You know this. Imei shat tchelus domel yam. The yam domel rakia. Tchelus reminds us of the sea. Sea reminds us of the sky. Rakia domel evan sapir reminds us of a sapphire. Sapir domel kisya kavod reminds us of kisya kavod. What's going on here? A quick game of artificial association. I think about tchelus. I look at my tchelus. Think about the sea, I think about the sky, it was like artificial. Listen carefully. Every chait is always based upon small-mindedness, by definition. Every chait is based upon losing perspective of who you are and what you're here on this world for. If you knew you were going to die next minute, and that the chait you were about to commit, despite its pleasure, would wreck your eternal future, and you are making a ghastly exchange of eternity for a moment of pleasure and transience, and you saw it and heard it that clearly, would any of you pull the trigger on that chait? None of you would. But we lose our minds, and we lose our vision, and we get caught in the moment, we get caught under pressure, and our bodies thirst, and our souls fear, and we take easy convenience in place of long-term challenge and growth. Every chait has a schar. It also has an onesh. You wouldn't commit a chait if it didn't have a schar. No one commits a chait just to commit a chait. Except the Mori Bashem flew to the house. Every chait gives you a pleasure, and you tell a lie, you get out of a tight situation. You tell a joke, put someone down, you build up your own ear. Every chait has something it gives you. Certainly the physical chataim. So the Gemara in Bava Basra, we'll talk about this Gemara in Chukas. Gemara says you should be mechashev, schar avera k'neged hetzedah. You should think about the schar. What do you mean schar avera? What do you mean schar? Shouldn't those give you schar for an avera? You get schar. You get something that you need. You get something your body needs, your psyche needs, your soul needs, something you need. But you get a tremendous avera, you get a tremendous onesh. Have said it. So much of avoiding chait is not just the hard-nosed, telescopic, mesilas yisharim, but perspective. Perspective. Take a few steps back. Step outside of your petty, small-minded, limited horizon moment. And think about, what's your purpose on this earth? Where's it all heading? What's it all about? Take a step back. Change your perspective. Keep your proportions intact. Maintain your sanity. So much of Parsha Shlach is the abandonment of perspective. So it's a tough land. So there are warriors. What? It's tougher than Mitzrayim. More difficult than Kriyas Yamsuf. More difficult than Har Sinai. The Meraglim's report was accurate. It was their spin that was despicable. It was their spin that showed a lack of faith, and to be honest, just even a lack of maturity and a lack of courage. Forget faith. Just do something courageous. So put your life on the line. It's worth it. So what that they're giants? So what that they're ferocious? Things of value demand struggle. So struggle. So work. You've already been there. It's not what they saw. It's their unwillingness to stand up and take that challenge. Just get lost in panic. I don't want to get lost in this conversation. I'm going to go back to Tzitzis. Just get lost in panic over it like grasshoppers. That's panic talking. They're projecting their own fears onto the local residents. No one was saying they were grasshoppers. They're projecting. It's projection 101. And you're really afraid of, you're assuming everyone's thinking about you. Oh, whatever your insecurities are, you're assuming everyone knows about you. That's projection 101. So our mayor is saying, you hit a moment of faith, don't just tell yourself it's us, and that may not save you. But travel. Step outside. Look at the chayles, let the chayles take you to the sea. Let the chayles take you to the sky. Even if you didn't get to Kisiakava. Remember the last time you were on a plane and you're landing and you're looking at the little houses underneath and you're saying, hey, that's me. That's my life, but I'm seeing it from a different perspective. I'm seeing it 10,000 feet up. At that one quick moment where you think about your life from a different angle, and then you get back into your regular routine and the plane lands and you join those little boxes, those little cars moving across the road. You're that one moment that you're seeing yourself out of your rhythm, out of tune, out of this normal routine that anesthetizes you. And that's a moment of epiphany. It's a moment of clarity. Tchelos is an epiphany. Tchelos is a moment of clarity. Sitting on top of this huge ocean with crashing waves, endless water. And you realize all those petty concerns that you have fade into this mass, into this large body of ocean, into this abyss. Think about the sky, about the cosmos, about the universe. All of a sudden you're taken to a different place. And you realize you're part of something larger. It's not just your drama and your life and your need, but there's a larger machinery involved. And you're part of that. You can affect that. And how dare you flinch at this opportunity? How dare you become weak in a moment of such universal importance? It's not just that you go to the water and the water takes you to the sky takes the Kisiakava. Even if you never get to the Kisiakava, even if you get to the ocean, you're in a better place than in the small little contours of your own psyche in which your need is so torrential that it overcomes your discipline and overcomes your inner strength. That's what the mayor said. Risem oso scharten is called mitzvos Hashem. You look at Tcheles and all of a sudden you see the Yam, you see the Shemayim, you see Kisya Kavod, and you're somewhere else. You're not in that little cell that you built for yourself or that reality is built for you. That's what Meir thought Tcheles could accomplish. I'll just end with one Gemara, since I mentioned the Gemara in Kul. There's so many beautiful Mamari Chazal on Tzitzis and Tcheles, but let's just read source number 2. Gimel 2, it's on the bottom of side 2, page 1. Maisavavim Echad Shem Rezavim Mitzvah Tzitzis, line 3. He's very careful about Tzitzis. Shama Sheyesh Zona Bekrache Hayam Shenatalas Dalad Meil Zehuvim Bishara. You heard about a Zona Medinas Hayam who took 400 Zuz for her price, for her services. Or there weren't any Zonas locally. You have to go Medinas Hayam to find a Zona. All this profession. So much of our desires are to be something else, to break the monotony. I spoke about this last week in Baloscha. The local seems so pedestrian, so dreary, so overworn or outworn. We're looking for that excitement, that foreign, exciting, other, distant, bohemian. He planted good zonas in his local street, but he had to go for that distant zona, krach ayam, some fantasy. Fantasy is always an alternative to our crushing and black and white, dreary reality. We're always looking to infuse a little color. Remember, I talked about Bilam and his response to the monotony of the month. So, Shigur Lach Dalad Meil Zehuvim, line number 5. Bavi Yashav Ala Pesach, he sits on a door, outside of her door, he finally arrives. Amrihi Yikanes, she says, come in. Nichnas Yitzhiya Lozai Mitos. She's sitting on top of 7 beds. Sheishol Kesef Yachas Shol Zav. 6 are silver and 1 is gold. Ben kolachas v'achas sulam shel kesef. There's a little sulam of kesef in between Delyona shel zav. And you can see the fantasy, the sheer, the dazzle, the pizzazz, the glow. It's not just sexual desire. It's fantasy, bright lights, colors, flair. the effect, you know, you walk into someone, you see how color manipulates human interests, how sound manipulates human interests, and so many different stimuli are made to grab you and hold you in a trance. No trance here in this room. It's regular light, regular air, regular people. That's substance. Sometimes you're taken out of the world of substance into a world of fantasy, into a world of stupor, into a world where all of a sudden you find your mind and your heart wandered. So he goes up and he rides on that seventh layer, that seventh bed, and she's there waiting for him because she had room without clothing on. Bo dalet tzitzi yosav v'tachlo apanav, and as he's about to take his clothing off, his tzitzis swack him in the face. Nishmati rolls off of the bed, v'yashav agave karka. He gets down to the ground, he wakes up, he shakes out of his hypnosis. Amrli gufa sharomi, eni mani chascha, the next page, she says, I'm not letting you leave. Achatamali mamma marisabi. Why don't you want me? She says, I'm so beautiful, I'm so attractive. Amar Lai tells her, Havoda, you're right, Shlori Isa Isha Yafa Kamoscha. I've never seen a more attractive woman. Hashem gave us one mitzvah. Ani Hashem Elokeichem. Ani Yusha Asa Lifara, Ani Yusha Asa Lashalim Schar. I see my tzitzis. I hope this never happens to anyone here. But it just speaks to the power of tzitzis. And not just tzitzis. Other factors and other stimulants and other props that you can create for yourself. You can't just trust your moral courage at every moment. He lost it. But his tzitzis saved the day. So whether you are tzitzis or tzitzis out or doesn't, or just please be makbid on tzitzis. Please be makbid. If you're someone that doesn't wear it regularly, it should be obvious to you to wear it regularly. Someone that gets away with, you know, second-rate tzitzis because it's a little more comfortable. You know, the basic hierarchy of tzitzis is as follows. You see, I don't want anyone to feel judged or anything. I don't know what you wear. We don't give the tzitzis test here. We don't put our hands down your back. I have no clue what anyone wears here. But the highest level of tzitzis would be wool tzitzis. That's Shittas HaRambam. Jiyotze, where the beggar is actually woolen. To be honest with you, you get used to it very quickly. It doesn't really. So I'm really looking at this mitzvah. Every second I'm getting a mitzvah. It should be a grade A mitzvah, not a grade B mitzvah. So, simple. So yeah, a week or two, it's a little uncomfortable. Then I don't wear undershirts. I wear it against my body, and I don't know the difference. You really couldn't tell you. It's all, I don't feel like I'm very tactile sensitive, so I would feel it if it really bothers me. Yeah, you wear it in practice, and he goes on. If you don't want to wear that, you should certainly prefer cotton tzitzis over fishnet tzitzis. My focus on poskim. Whether you're yotze with fishnet tzitzis, many posts can say you are yotze, and that's how most of the world rules. But again, to put yourself into a situation of a machlokas aposki and a mitzvah that's so basic, when it is relatively easy kata. Something I want to say also for people, I see sometimes people are walking around during summer camps. Some people are going to summer camps, and some people wear the tzitzis on their body, Baruch Hashem, and on top of their shirts, and they wear the tzitzis like a scarf or something. You have to be yotze tzitzis with two in front and two in back. It has to be worn like a beged. If you're wearing tzitzis and it's, you know, all the four tzitzis are thrown behind you so that you can run or something, you may as well not be wearing them. Yotze tzitzis has to be worn like a beged, two in front and two in back. So that's just the ha'ara. I've been in summer camps and I've seen people running around. They wouldn't be carrying the mitzvah. They're not being carrying the mitzvah because, you know, even if you say that you are makayim the fishnet, you know, just behind you, you're not makayim the mitzvah. So it's a good opportunity, Parsha Shlach, to think about mitzvah tzitzis, the chazek, this mitzvah, and the general attitudes behind it.
Same
is. Same
is.
Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is. Same is